Hey everybody, welcome to Mossback, the official podcast of the Mossbacks Northwest video series from Cascade PBS. I'm Stephen Haig.
And I'm Knut Berger.
And today, we're talking about clams.
Gotta go for the chowder, for sure. What else?
One of the Pacific Northwest's most beloved foods. Clams show up everywhere, from thousands of years of aquaculture.
For thousands of years, people have modified the environment to open up more space for clams.
To one of Seattle's favorite restaurant chains.
A clam entree, clam nectar.
Okay, so should we get a full clam? Full clam.
Not to mention my own childhood.
And of course, we dug for razor clams.
They're such a big part of our culture here. If you haven't already seen the video, take a few moments to watch it. It'll make this conversation more interesting and relevant. You can find the video in the show notes, but for now, let's dig in.
Excuse me, mister, what do you have there in your bag? Oh, nothing. Looks like a gooey duck to me.
Knut, there's an old 8mm film of my own family out digging for razor clams on the Washington coast many, many years ago. You know, with razor clams, you have to be quick. When you see that spout, you start shoveling like crazy. So you see my mom in her plaid Filson jacket. You'd be so proud of her. Digging a hole with this small collapsible army shovel, then getting on her hands and knees and reaching into that hole, just running after that critter. And sometimes, you know, you need the shovel again. You got to dig faster. You have to dig in another direction. That's where you see me and my little brother, Keith, grabbing the shovel and running off with it just as she needs it. Because we want to dig razor clams, too. It's a memory that is so close to me because I can almost smell the seashore. And then the memory of going home with buckets of clams, whether they be butter clams or razor clams. So clams definitely are a part of my very early experience and my very early culture.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you're not alone in the love of clams and razor clams. I mean, it goes back as far as recorded human history here in the Pacific Northwest. Razor clams are incredibly, you know, people find them incredibly desirable. You know, you hunt clams. It's not in the same way that you hunt oysters or even hunt mussels because they're running away.
That's right. It's not a passive experience.
Exactly.
You've got to go for it.
It's a chase. It's a challenge, you know, like your mother, you know, getting that shovel and digging fast enough. Can you beat the clam? I found some statistics that I thought were really interesting from the Department of Fish and Wildlife in Washington because as we're recording this, they've opened the razor clam season.
Ooh, good size one.
So in 2021 and 22, 8.4 million razor clams were dug up on Washington coast beaches.
On a Friday night, down here at the beach, razor clam.
So people went out to Moclips, they went out to Long Beach. I mean, 8.4 million, and this represents hundreds of thousands of clamming trips. You know, because people can go and they might have a limit of 15 clams.
Right.
That's going to do it today for us guys. We got our limit.
But it's also one of those things that if you don't know what the delicacy of razor clams is, it's something that could completely escape you. My spouse knows how to fry these razor clams, and it's unlike anything I've ever tasted. So
yeah.
It's right there. It's the bounty of the Northwest.
And the fact that it's free is also compelling, right?
Well, there's an old adage you bring up in the video, quote, when the tide is out, the table is set. Do we know where that comes from?
I don't know where it comes from, except that I know that expression was used in the pioneer period, and I'm sure they picked it up from indigenous people because so many were reliant for much of the year on what they could harvest from the sea. You know, smoking clams was part of preparing food for winter. It was part of a trade networks. So they would build these long ropes of smoked clams, necklaces almost, you know, and these were traded beyond the Cascades into eastern Washington. So the vitalness of this resource was recognized from time immemorial. I mean, for people who lived in coastal saltwater areas, shellfish were pretty ubiquitous. You know, the people that were here before the settlers came knew about it. The settlers quickly found out about it. It was a cheap source of very healthy food, right? Protein.
Did clams provide almost a life-saving resource for people like the Denny Party and other early settlers when they came, just as Dungeness crabs did to some of the explorers who were exploring the Washington coast?
Yeah, I mean, there's a great story about Roland Denny, who was the last surviving member of the Denny Party. He lived into old age, died in the late 1930s, arrived with his family at Alki Point, cold winter day of 1851. Roland Denny was just an infant. He was only a couple months old, maybe a little older. And I'll read you a bit from Roland Denny's obituary. On arriving at the Alki home, the mother had to wean her babe. There was no milk to be had, but the baby was nursed to rugged boyhood on clam juice. So the mother was ill and having trouble nursing. And the Duwamish women who met them had a solution for that. So it was obviously a known thing. And as this newspaper article points out, Roland Denny grew up, had a robust boyhood. I think there was a sense that clams were not only free, they were available, you could find them, but they were extremely nourishing. And, you know, clam nectar, clam juice, you know, there are people who still drink it today.
Oh, yeah. I think I know one of those people who drink it today. We'll get to that a bit later. Well, I'm curious, what interested you about this subject anyway as a part of the video series?
Well, one thing was that every time we've done an episode about food, people like that, you know, recipes or, you know, so we did Crab Louie.
Who invented the Northwest seafood salad everyone loves? Who invented Crab Louie?
We did the native oysters, the Olympias.
It became a major industry, but it was so tiny that you could hold it between your fingers. Meet the mighty Olympia oyster.
You know, in writing stories about Northwest archaeology, you're often led to information that's derived from shell middens.
And left the evidence in old repositories of dining debris we call shell middens.
Which are basically refuse pits, but some of them are thousands of years old. And so you can see over time what a population was eating and throwing away and other things. And of course, these middens have become buried. They become part of the shoreline. So I was kind of thinking about doing a food episode and thinking, well, you know, clams would be interesting because a very high proportion of these shell middens is made up of clam shells. And then we've also heard recently about kind of a revival of indigenous clam gardens.
At Swinomish, we've started the first modern clam garden.
So it just seemed like a subject that had a nice relevance to now.
Right. The Swinomish have begun rebuilding a clam garden on Kicket Island out in Skagit Bay.
It's basically like a terrace of rocks that is built at the intertidal zone, which is the optimal habitat for the clams to grow.
To preserve and continue the aquaculture of clams.
Also, First Nations people up in British Columbia are doing the same thing. Some of them have been doing it for years. And one of the things I kind of went to in reading about this was reading about some middens on Haida Gwaii. It's in northern British Columbia, islands off the coast. And I was reading about some of the remains they found in these places that were inhabited up to 14,000 years ago. So you're talking about habitation in the period, the early part of the melting period. And they were finding lots of shellfish, clams, and others. And that reminded me of a sculpture by a Haida artist that captures the story of a Haida origin of humanity myth. And it just kind of hit me, you know, here are people who have a story about the first men being found inside a clamshell.
Humanity springing from inside a shell.
Yeah, very specifically a clamshell. Apparently, Raven finds this clamshell on the beach and notices there are these wiggling things inside. And so he basically opens it up and pulls these creatures out, and these become the first people. And there's this amazing sculpture by Bill Reed, and it's at the University of British Columbia's Anthropology Building, and it's this gorgeous, huge sculpture that shows the clamshell with these wriggling beings in it and this giant raven perched on top. It's a very famous piece of artwork, particularly in Canada.
So the weather's nice enough we could eat outside today, maybe here.
Speaking of the importance of clams and other shellfish, of course, one of the most iconic Seattle seafood restaurants has long been Ivers.
How long is the pier down at Ivers?
And a discussion of clams wouldn't be complete without mentioning Iver. Have you been to Ivers restaurants over the years? Were they a staple of yours?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We would, go out to dinner there. I used to work across the street from Ivers Acres of Clams on the waterfront when I was editor of Seattle Weekly. And if I was getting stressed out and had had too much coffee, I would sometimes run under the viaduct, go to the takeout bar there at Ivers and get a big cup of clam nectar, hot clam nectar. And yeah, I love it.
I thought they stopped making it, but maybe they still sell it here.
You mean the clams would stop making it? No.
And we went down to Ivers just the other day. Our producer, Sarah Bernard, accompanied us, and it was a very cold but very nice sunny day, and we went down to Acres of Clams.
This is very exciting. I'm going to have my first ever clam nectar moment here.
So you had your clam nectar, and we ran into some people who were Mossback fans, but also fans of clam nectar.
What does that phrase Acres of Clams mean to you?
Lots and lots of undisturbed and always available clams.
Have you ever had clam nectar?
Yes, it's amazing.
What does it do to your mind and your body?
It totally clears it and makes you smarter.
Is it the nectar of the gods, so to speak?
Pretty much, yes.
It was good for the Denny's, you know, it's good enough for the rest of us.
Well, speaking of clam nectar tonics, as you pointed out in the video, apparently it was suggested that it might be an aphrodisiac. I don't know if you have personal experience or if you do know
no
where that idea comes from, or is that just part of the hype?
You hear that about shellfish. You hear it about oysters. Sure. You hear it about clams. And Ivor had a thing that he used to say where, you know, if you had more, I can't remember exactly the thing, but it was basically, you know, if you drink more than one cup, you must have written permission from your wife.
If you drink clam nectar, then really by Hector, you'll feel something new that you never felt before. Your eye will be brighter, your step will be lighter, and love and true romance will knock at your door.
I mean, the reason we talk about Ivor Hagland and clams and seafood in general, but certainly clams, is because he was the one who revived a folk song about clams.
I've traveled all over this country, and I'll say that if man ever found a place to be peaceful and quiet, that spot is on Puget Sound.
That was written in the 1870s. And Ivor was a folk singer in addition to being a restaurant entrepreneur. And that's where the term Acres of Clams comes from, this song, which is basically it's a song that basically says, if you come to the Northwest, if you come to Puget Sound country and you're no good at anything, it's okay, relax, because there are acres of clams here that you can harvest and eat, and you'll be okay. It doesn't matter if you were a terrible prospector, farmer, whatever.
I laugh at the world and it shams as I think of my happy condition, surrounded by acres of clams.
It's an ode to simple happiness in the bounty of the Northwest.
It is. And Ivor used this to promote his seafood business on the waterfront.
That chowder you get down at Ivor's, and Ivor's on Pier 54.
Plunking on his guitar.
Yeah, exactly. Plunking away.
Happy flavor for worth trying and buying. And eating again, you'll like it. And I hope you'll come down real soon.
Did you ever meet Ivor?
I did. Just once. A good friend of mine, a guy I went to college with, got a job when Ivor bought the Smith Tower. He got a job putting out a little newsletter called the Smith Tower View. It was basically a newsletter for tenants of the Smith Tower to keep them informed. It was like a little inside deal. And one time we were hanging out and he had to run an errand and we went down to Ivor's salmon house. And Ivor was there, and I got to meet. It was introduced, and you know, if you think about Seattle celebrities of that era, they were few and far between. We had Bobo the Gorilla, you know, and you know, Ivor Hagland was probably the most recognizable person in town.
Was he crusty or folksy or?
I think he could be both, you know, and I think he was a very good businessman. My meeting with him was very brief. It was sort of getting to meet him in his lair there. Yeah, he was very friendly, and he and my friend had some business to do, so they got to chatting, and then we left, you know. So it was a very brief encounter.
Ivor's seafood can't be beat on Pier 54, foot of Madison Street. And here's a reminder just for you. Ivor's Fish Bar is open till 2.
What was Ivor's larger contribution? And it seems that Ivor has sort of receded from public consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing people remember him as well as they do. Partly it's just because the brand is still ubiquitous. You know, you can get Ivor's chowder on the ferry boat. You can get Ivor's chowder at a Seahawks game. So they've done a very good job of, you know, keeping the brand alive. I think for older Seattleites, he represents an old Seattle, you know, a Seattle where kind of a goofy waterfront restaurant guy could be a civic savior. You weren't hoping a billionaire comes along and buys a football team. You hoped that Ivor could buy the Smith Tower and put a windsock on top and save it from greedy investors. I think there was just something. He was born and raised here. He was a local product.
But still typified sort of that Norwegian immigrant guy who made good.
Yes, absolutely. And he was a guy who could turn failure into success by having a sense of humor.
And I say you can bring the whole family and come dressed any way that keeps you and the city police comfortable.
And I think people really appreciated that. He was also one of the first people to recognize that the waterfront was going to become a lifestyle place, a tourist place, not just a big busy port. You know, started a little aquarium down on the waterfront that turned it into his restaurant, and that became part of his restaurant empire. I think he was part of a very important transformation. People didn't necessarily recognize it that at the time, but, and he's still there.
You okay?
I'm wondering if a seagull just took a shit on my audio recorder.
Well,
but
it's something that's dripping from up there, and I don't
know. No, that looks like seagull poo.
It might be seagull poo. Okay.
It's bird poo.
A little bit of rain on a sunny day. Oh boy.
Well, one of the most interesting clams, of course, in the Northwest is the gooey duck. Have you ever been gooey duck hunting? Was your family were they gooey duck aficionados?
No. I mean, unlike your family, we ate clams occasionally, and I personally have been clamming once or twice, but it was never a family ritual. But everybody knows gooey ducks just because of the drama of their look.
This thing is a beast, but it's weird looking. It resembles a certain male part that shall not be named. Because once you see it, you're gonna know. It's called the gooey duck clam.
So I went to the Evergreen State College in Olympia, and our mascot is the gooey duck.
The fighting gooey ducks.
The fighting gooey ducks, yes.
The digging gooey ducks.
And the school motto is let it all hang out in Latin, omina exteris.
And the motto and the gooey duck seem to fit each other quite well because this is an animal that... most clams, as most of you are aware, can pull it all back in the shell and they just sit there in a compact little bundle. But the gooey duck's just overdone himself and he can't get it all back in. He's got to let it hang out. There's no way. It's just there.
The school was founded in the late 60s, early 70s, so it was kind of a joke on school mascots, et cetera. But it was also a critter that was plentiful in South Puget Sound. And when I was in college, I worked at a tavern, and after work, there were gooey duck divers who would come in.
Gooey duck fishermen were some regulars at the bar, and they were tough dudes.
You know, gooey ducks are very large clams. They have this, and I think there's a Chinese term for gooey ducks that reflects this. It looks like a giant elephant's trunk. And of course, this is the neck and siphon of the gooey duck. People look at it. It's very phallic. They think it's a sex organ, but it's not. You know, they tend to burrow very deep and in deeper water. So they were often only accessible to people for gathering when the tide was way, way out, you know, those low summer tides.
The commercial guys were scuba diving, basically, or, you know, diving with oxygen.
Well, in my family, as far as I remember, we didn't eat gooey ducks. They were nothing that we were interested in. And of course, and now they're very precious.
Of all the shellfish that sell on the black market, one clam is above the rest, the gooey duck.
There was a gooey duck theft that the federal Fish and Wildlife investigators were on to.
Right there. Stop. These officers are breaking up a black market of illegally harvested shellfish.
People stealing them off of public underwater ground.
Right.
Yeah.
But a very organized thing because they're so valuable, especially in Asia.
And they can get really big and they can get really old. You know, they can live for 100 years or more. And so there's such a thing as old growth gooey ducks.
This was a surprising thing I came across, which was just that there were two camps about how gooey duck was spelled. And they were duking it out. And then it was almost like the Tahoma Rainier Mountain controversy. It was, do you spell gooey duck G-O-E-D-U-C-K or G-E-O-D-U-C-K? You know, people have spelled it like G-O-O-E-Y duck to get the pronunciation. Apparently, some people in some dictionaries said it was to be pronounced geoduck, as if spelled with a J-E-O, geoduck. And it comes from a Lushootse word. It's often attributed to the Nisqually, and it's spelled G-W-E-D-U-C, so geoduck. And apparently, you know, that meant dig deep, although people have debated about where the name came from and all that. And it seems like the Seattle Times had an editorial in the 1920s saying, look, it's G-O-E-D-U-C-K, period, you know, final. But it's the geoduck spelling that has caught on and continues to trip people up who don't know much about it to mispronounce it.
That's fascinating.
So, you know, as part of looking at how clams were part of the culture, I came across a clipping about a Chautauqua assembly that was held regularly for many years on Vashon Island. They actually named a place on Vashon Island Chautauqua because they held this event there. And the Chautauqua was based on these sort of gatherings started in Chautauqua, New York, where you'd come together for sermons and speeches and kind of like TED Talks, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century. And they're very popular, and they included outdoor recreation and picnics, clam bakes, things like that. At least here, clam bakes were a big deal. And the clipping I came across was actually from 1894, and it says, all the teachers of the Sound Country have been invited to visit Chautauqua and will be given a clam bake and coffee lunch in the Grove at 1 o'clock. Clam chowder, clams baked, and clam steaks will be served in profusion. Dr. Pomeroy's class has been very successful in its pursuit of the piddock, the Washington clam, and the gooey duck. They have succeeded in capturing several that weigh from 5 to 7 pounds each, which will be on exhibition on Wednesday when the doctor will explain their habits and peculiarities and tell how they are caught. The epicures on the beach claim that gooey duck steak excels in flavor of the finest chicken. And I think this goes back to the earliest times of hospitality. Whether it's indigenous people or settlers, you see lots of accounts in the old newspapers and memoirs of clam bakes, of gatherings where the clams are kind of the food that holds us all together.
Our history with clams is very colorful, but what is the future of clams in our region?
Well, for one thing, clam harvests, like with razor clams, have to be carefully managed now. You know, you have to have firm prohibitions in terms of when you can collect, how many you can collect.
Not huge, but nice and tasty.
So they're not unlimited. I mean, we've learned this about all of our resources, right? They're not unlimited. You can't treat them the same way we treated them in the 20th century. I mean, the big thing is climate change.
In 2021, we experienced the heat dome for the first time. So it was a mass mortality for all of the shellfish across the Salish Sea.
And ocean acidification is an issue for all the shellfish, pretty much. It inhibits the growth of shells. And so the trying to control those variables with aquaculture of various kinds and is very important. The revival of clam gardens is important to that. The other part, too, is if you have warmer waters, you have more bacteria. You have algal blooms that can turn clams into something toxic that will kill people or hurt people.
Harmful toxins delayed the harvest for months this year.
Yeah, I know the population of razor clams goes up and way down and just has to be monitored all the time. Because of algae blooms and over-harvesting habitat, all of the things that threaten our world.
Yeah, and I think some of the habitats are disrupted by climate change. And as you say, over-harvesting, I don't think there's much of a razor clam business in California anymore, for example. It's pretty much the Northwest up to Alaska. So all of those things need to be managed, need to be accounted for. I think it's just one of those things where everybody has to be much more attentive to how the knee bone's connected to the thigh bone in our environment.
Yeah. To be happy as a clam means a lot of different things now than it did hundreds of years ago.
Yeah. I mean, like everything else, maybe it's a little harder to accomplish.
Thanks for listening to Mossback. If you'd like to see all the episodes from this season of Mossbacks Northwest, you can find them at cascadepbs.org. The video series is now in its 9th season. A new episode airs on Cascade PBS every Thursday night through May. This episode of Mossback was produced by Sarah Bernard. Our story editor and executive producer is Sarah Menzies. You can subscribe to the Mossback podcast wherever you listen. And whatever platform you're listening on, please review us. We'd love to know what you think of the show. And check out the show notes if you want to get in touch. Also, if you'd like to support the work we do, whether it's our lineup of podcasts, the video docuseries we stream every week, or the in-depth reporting we deliver every day, go to cascadepbs.org. In addition to supporting our journalism, members receive complete access to the on-demand programming of Cascade PBS. And being a member means you can sign up for an exclusive weekly Mossback Den newsletter from Knute Berger, where he offers greater insight into his latest historical discoveries. Mossback is a product of Cascade PBS. I'm Stephen Haig. We'll be back soon with another episode.